We started out doing this in the sanctuary and we realized that wasn't going to work. I think we were a bit naive about the condition of the people that we were trying to help. They were much more vulnerable, physically more damaged and emotionally.
Welcome back to UU Expressions Love in Real Life. I am your co-host, Amber Belmar, and I am joined by the CUC's Justice and Equity Lead, Aaron Horvath. If you've been with us since the beginning, you've arrived to episode 6 of a 10-episode docuseries that discovers, celebrates, and challenges how Unitarian Universalism is practiced across Canada in 2024. In this episode, we will learn how people are harnessing UU values to create meaningful change in their communities. That was Catherine Jane Hazel from the First Unitarian Fellowship of Nanaimo, describing the beginnings of the Nanaimo Unitarian Shelter they created for those who were unhoused in their city. When we think about how people find their way to UUism, we might first think about the congregational expression. However, we heard some interesting and exciting stories of people engaging with UUism through a community-based ministry. Some of these are freestanding initiatives and others are connected to a particular congregation, but as the name suggests, community ministry is focused on bringing value to the larger community. It could look like a social service, such as a shelter. It could look like social enterprise, such as a cafe or bike shop. It could look like outreach, such as the work lay chaplains do, or even community partnerships, such as low-income or Indigenous housing projects.
Right, and given that community-based ministries operate differently than congregations, there are different types of conversations that these groups are having about how to meet needs, share their vision, be economically sustainable, and engage others in ways that include partnerships, customers, and employment relationships. Let's start with Wendy Luella Perkins of Soulful Singing, a community of singers that meet daily online to explore UU values through song. For those who are just meeting Wendy Luella now, in episode 1, we learned that her group of about 50 people engages people within Canada, the United States, and some even farther away, and that 70% of the members are not UUs. I asked Wendy Luella about her plans to build more economic sustainability into her community-based ministry using a grant she recently received from the Unitarian Universalist Association.
But that's part of the plan for the Unitarian Universalist Funding Panel grant, the Singing the Songs for the Journey process, is to develop this home base for my music online and that people would actually subscribe to that. And so it will be an ongoing source of income that I would be putting up new music all the time and that people would subscribe to it with a sliding scale. So congregations could subscribe and then have the freedom to use all the music that's there in a year in worship, in community activities, in protests or whatever, and do it in a way that's honoring copyright and also supporting me and my ministry.
Having an online portal where people can purchase her work is a new endeavor and a very important one to support her community-based ministry. At the time, she was in the process of considering what models she wanted to use and how she wanted to get the word out. Leaning into the unknown seems to be a theme for her since the start of the pandemic, as she has turned what used to be an in-person ministry into a thriving online community using approaches that were new to her, including TikTok.
So I'm very, very excited. And I have to say the TikTok thing, like what? It won't really age me, but just to say I'm on the other side of 55. And the idea of being on TikTok, never would have. But there was a person that comes to Soulful Singing, Keith, who was so encouraging. He was like, these are wonderful songs. More people need to know about them. And I really want to encourage you. And so I said, well, what about TikTok? And he goes, okay. And so now I have maybe 105 of my own songs on TikTok. I think I've had maybe 45,000 views of those songs. And I would never have reached those people without all of these cascading things. I feel very grateful that the unfolding has happened like this for me personally in my ministry. And the TikTok thing is hilarious and wonderful.
Who would have imagined having a TikTok ministry? That is such a great example of embracing new ways of building community.
Right? And having 45,000 views is a substantial reach. many of which would not be UUs, but rather lovers of meaningful music. Building an audience on social media is an example of a strategy that is very common in businesses, as is the development of an online portal to sell things.
Right. And while this approach may be uncommon to other people in professional ministry, it can totally be an effective way to bring her some economic sustainability.
The people she serves, they do contribute to her financially. However, many are living in poverty, and what they can collectively contribute is not enough to sustain her life. Wendy Luello was clear that right now it's possible for her to engage in her ministry as she does because she has a partner whose income supports their household. Taking the step to generate other revenues is a wonderful way to diversify income sources while staying true to the vision of getting her songs out into the world.
This reminds me of the conversation with Liz James from Mirth and Dignity.
Yes, and they do so many amazing things to support UUs. In fact, they helped Wendy Luella prepare and submit the grant application to the UUA. One thing, though, Mirth and Dignity functions because Liz is in a financial position to volunteer her time and energy to the nonprofit. And while it is so awesome that both of these people contribute what they do, both ministries could cease to exist if circumstances changed and they're no longer able or willing to volunteer their time.
And as we heard in several interviews, being able to volunteer time is a privilege that some people get to enjoy and others do not. The reality is that to ensure the longevity of a community-based ministry, one would be wise to develop strategies for a diversified income.
UniCamp is a well-known and loved Unitarian Universalist camp in Ontario that was started in 1969 and currently has 17 member congregations. However, as we'll hear from their current executive director, Yvette Salinas, and camp director, Johanna Barrington, they have always had to work to balance their mission with their finances, especially now as congregational resources are lower than they have been in past generations. Here's Yvette with her perspective on the purpose of UniCamp.
I would say the purpose of UniCamp is to be constantly holding a space for people to figure themselves out and be in community, finding themselves in nature and reflecting on who they are as UU, and realizing that nature is reflecting UU back at them, and so are the campers around them.
Not the answer I was expecting. That's cool.
That's what I said. And here's Johanna expanding on the purpose.
Like, I hear oftentimes people who grow up going to camps who, like, queer families who are going to camp who don't have a space where they feel safe and welcome. And so this is creating a space for so many people to come and enjoy camp in such a lovely community setting. But then also, you know, being outside, our everything is outside. You walk outside to go get food. You walk outside to go visit friends. And it's just so nice to be surrounded by trees and plants and wonderful people who have, I want to say, a same way of thinking, but yet a different way of thinking. That's all why we all think the same, is because it's wonderful to be different. And that's the kind of community that we're trying to create for people, for children and youth and families, that everyone feels welcome in.
Now, I was curious how this camp came to be.
Tom Brown, Yvette, you might know better than me. I guess he bought it. I don't know. You'll have to maybe touch on that one, because he bought it for $1 from Dave Hartman, and he wanted to provide an opportunity for...
for your use. It was really for children to do RE during the summer.
We need to brush up on our history. But
no, it's really funny because somebody bought it and they were like, you can have it for cheap. Like, you're going to do something special with it. And then a whole bunch of UUs got together and they're like, this is what we can do. There were already dorms on there. There were six little bunkies where it could fit, what, 36 bunk beds or something. So already it lent itself to a summer camp idea. And because it happened to be in the hands of UUs, they decided to use it as RE program for children.
RE being religious education.
Yes, and so not unlike other churches of that time where kids would have a vacation Bible school or something of that nature, this was a place for the UU equivalent. Yvette, Joanna, and I spoke about how the purpose has expanded over time and shared some stories about the magic of inclusivity people report experiencing there.
It started with this idea of children's RE education, and then through time it has become about a space that does have this feeling of inclusivity. And I've heard that, by the way, at the inclusivity forums and things like that, where we've looked at all different types of inclusivity and what groups need. And I remember hearing a variety of stories, some from queer folks, some from polyamorous folks. One young person said they found out that they weren't broken and damaged because they were feeling really in their emotions at uni camp, and it was about whether they could uphold monogamy, and they were just, in their opinion, not doing it well. And someone sat down and said, oh, well, I'm polyamorous, and this is how it kind of works. And that's how they found their values within their lives, like to understand how they would do things differently and what that meant. It was quite emotional, actually, listening to that.
So beautiful. I love that
story. Yeah. It's actually a recorded story because it was for one of the forums that they shared it, that that's how they found out they weren't irreparably damaged. So we keep hearing these tales of inclusivity and what it's meant to folks.
I wouldn't say people beyond Ontario really understand what's happening there. Before I went there, I had no idea. I thought it was like a, you ship your kids there, they do their thing, they come back, that's done. People are hearing about us, but not understanding what's going on. I would love it if every region had its own version of UniCamp. I don't need all Canadians to come to camp, but it would be awesome if they had their own.
Having interviewed several people in Ontario, I can attest to the wonderful impact that UniCamp has had. Lucy Dilkus, who spoke to me about Heronia's nomadic approach to UUism, expressed that it is one of the locations that she and others will frequent, many of those people being non-UUs. According to Joanna, this is a frequent occurrence.
A lot of the people that come to UniCamp heard through word of mouth, you know, they really connect with people in their home communities, whether they're Unitarian or not. I like to say identify as a Unitarian because some people are very Unitarian without knowing that they're Unitarian, you know? And so you meet people who just fit the values, and that's why you connect with them. And so, like, I've got a lot of friends and family members who I tell about UniCamp because their values just totally align with what Unitarianism is. So they might actually find out about UUism through UniCamp.
A lot of our most enthusiastic first-time visitors came because they heard from somebody else who came and had an awesome experience. It's when they get those awesome stories like you just told us, Erin, that they're like, I want that for myself, or I want that for my kids.
I've been to UniCamp once for a young adult retreat, but I don't know what else happens there to draw these UUs and non-UUs together.
Well, primarily they're a children and youth camp and have about 4 to 5 weeks dedicated to this each summer. They have a big focus on teenagers and young adults. About 90% of the staff are young adults. In addition, they have family camps, weekend programs, workshops, private cottages, private rentals, seasonal campers, and a range of special events such as marriages and dance camps where a group rents the whole facility. While there are a variety of reasons people come to camp, Joanna and Yvette were clear that the thing they have in common is their values, which includes UU values, but also the community values they cultivate.
So they offer experiences of UU community in nature, leadership development for young people, and a venue that can be rented. I would say UniCamp is a form of social enterprise in that it is always balancing the joint goals of social good and financial sustainability. But I'm curious then, what is the legal structure of UniCamp?
So they're a registered charity, which might be surprising to some of our listeners. Here's Yvette explaining more.
Officially, we do have member congregations, about a dozen member congregations. So they are the ones that send delegates to our yearly annual general meeting. Big, big decisions have to go by those members. They can tell us whether they want us to go in another direction. And so far, it seems they're happy with what we're doing.
The board members are from all different member congregations and have direct experience with a particular aspect of the camp, such as being a former staff member, or a seasonal camper, or a parent of children who attend. Joanna and Yvette indicated that about 2 years ago, the board undertook a process of creating the covenant that now governs their interactions.
Okay, I imagine that having a board made up of people with an insider's experience of UniCamp could be both to their benefit and also create some challenges.
Absolutely. And Yvette explained that the covenant was a positive moment in the camp's history as it helped board members create the parameters for how they would relate productively and respectively together.
And that was a big shift, honestly. It was a hard process getting it actually written down. This is how they're going to be talking. They have to understand that when they're there as a board member, they're not there as a seasonal camper. They're not there as a parent. They have to be thinking for the good of the whole organization. And that was part of the covenant. We do revisit it every year as the new board members come in. It's been so helpful, though, because sometimes we can get really heated and being able to say, hey, remember that thing that we all discussed at the beginning?
While this board is the group the organization is ultimately accountable to, it is not the group that makes decisions about the daily happenings at the camp.
I've talked about the youth and young adult staff. That, I think, is our golden treasure at Unicamp. I'm trying as an ED to like really keep myself open to things that they would suggest about how we should be running, because they just have so much more passion than maybe they've been given credit for. And I want to empower them to bring in things for the good of the kids and the families, that they are the ones that have to implement it, so they would know. Having that 80%+ of our staff members being the youth and young adults is awesome. We're being more intentional about actually saying we're confident in you. What is it that you think we should be focusing more on? How can we be supporting you? And I think that's working. That's one of the reasons that they come back, even though the work is hard and your days are super long. But if you ever have an idea like, hey, I'm going to build this bike rack. Yeah, go for it. I think having that capability is what brings in some more of our youth and young adults into these roles.
And are these paid roles?
Oh, yeah.
Do they get paid a salary or an honorarium, or how do they get paid?
Yes, weekly salary.
In addition to being a radically inclusive camp, equipping young people to make meaningful decisions is another thing that makes Unicamp unique. A child or youth attending could look up to these young adults and imagine that one day they too could be in a position of leadership, helping co-create the future of the place they love. Now, with this youth-focused mission, however, there are some unique considerations in this post-COVID world, such as the mental health of the youth and young adults that has really taken a hit, not just generally, but specifically in terms of the youth that attend the camp and the young adults that run the camp. I asked how this is impacting their social enterprise, and here's one example Yvette shared.
Their social batteries are a lot shorter, or their ability to be with the group of kids would be for shorter lengths of time than they maybe would have before. Energy levels depleted a little bit and so on. So like this past summer, we tried to bring in more floaters so that they don't actually have their own camp group, but they can step in case a counselor needs to take a break. We're trying to do more of that. But of course, that ends up being another paid role. It means, okay, what's the impact on the budget? And there's a domino effect there.
Both Yvette and Joanna spoke at length about the various supports and resources that they're bringing in to support the youth, not just for their own benefit as people, but because they are understood to be the treasure of Unicamp. When they suffer, so does the whole community. As someone who grew up in Unicamp and was on staff, Joanna shared the differences she has witnessed over time and how it impacts their operations.
When I got my first job, you would work hard and say yes to every shift. I show them that I want this job. I'm going to work hard to get it. I'm going to bend over backwards just to get there. And we've seen a shift general where now young people are finally speaking up for themselves and they get a job and say, I can work, but you know, I have vacation planned with my family for a week here and a week there. And they're able to say yes to the job. But here are my boundaries around all of that. So they're finally starting to speak up for themselves, which is amazing. We really tried to go back to pre-pandemic, but you add in that social burnout that we're talking about. And then you also add in youth are finally standing up for themselves. So it's been this funny balance of making things back to normal, but yet better and different, if that makes sense. That's the reality of hiring and empowering youth to do this job and teaching them. I was talking earlier about mentorship, and you know, we want to create leaders out of these young people, and we want them to become the executive director one day and the camp director one day. It's amazing to think about all the opportunities that we're giving to them. It's this balance of we're their employer, so we need to tell them what's what in a sense, but we still need to hear from them. Like Yvette was saying, let's hear about their ideas and what change do they want to see happen.
I recognize the activism training built into this way of relating.
Yes, and they share that these young adult staff who have become strong advocates for themselves tend to extend their advocacy to their campers in trying to create a more democratic process, even in terms of giving campers choice over what they do with their time instead of programming everything down to a T, which they recognize is different from past generations where camp directors and camp counselors called the shots and the campers were expected to go along with it.
So this creates quite a unique set of circumstances where the social goals of being radically inclusive and training up young people to be strong advocates are combined with a reality that people are paying for an experience of beloved community within this venue. Plus, they have to balance income and expenses in a way that ensures that it can not only survive, but thrive for future generations to enjoy.
Yes, and while they never presented themselves as a social enterprise, and in fact shied away from conversations using words typically associated with businesses such as brand, customer, profit, loss, scaling up, those sort of things, the reality is that they are taking on operating a values-driven social enterprise.
It seems community ministry and social enterprise have a lot in common, and thinking in these terms might open the doors for more sustainable UU initiatives in the future.
First Unitarian Congregation of Ottawa is engaged in a community project that is not currently operating as a social enterprise, but is grappling with questions related to long-term financial sustainability. They have linked up with an Indigenous teacher and horticulturalist with a passion for teaching Indigenous youth how to grow their own food. The Ottawa First Campus is home base for this initiative.
Hello, my name is Kiyoki White Duck, and I am the lead of the Ajashki project here.
And I'm Lynn Kothmel Preston. I'm a member of the Circle of Support.
A unique aspect of this initiative is that Kiyoki, who provides leadership for the initiative, is not a UU. However, he is supported by the group of UUs that Lynn is a part of. Here's Kiyoki explaining what Ajashki is.
The Ajashki Project, we're in our third year now, and we're now running as a special reconciliation program here at the First Unitarian Congregation in Ottawa. We are an Indigenous learning center. We specialize in food security and climate change and how they're both related. We take youth, primarily Indigenous youth, being between 13 and 30, to come participate in our program and learn how to grow their own food, how to cook their own food. We study a lot about just gardening, different types of gardening. We have an outside garden where we produce food all summer long. And then we also have indoor gardens by the means of aeroponic growing towers, which we can actually grow food in all year long. We also do a lot about Indigenous cultures and language. Sometimes we have elders come in. I myself am Algonquin, so we started learning about the Algonquin language. This year in our program, we've actually had a lot of Inuit participants, so we started learning some Inuktitut. We kind of gear a lot of this program around the needs of the youth. A lot of the youth we have are food insecure, so that's why we have such a heavy focus on the food security aspect. And we also focus a lot on mental wellness. A lot of the youth we have face systemic barriers or problems in their own life.
Kiyoki explained the history of this ambitious initiative.
We started officially in 2021, but in 2020, some of the members here at First U had a sharing circle with an elder from my community named Verna McGregor, and they were asking what they could do around reconciliation. And that's when Verna gave them the idea of an Indigenous Learning Center, which was, of course, a big step at the time. So what they started with, what about an Indigenous program? And that's kind of how the idea started. About a few months later, these people from First U, being Sharon Bowen, Lynn, and a few others got in contact with myself and asked me, hey, we're interested in starting an Indigenous gardening program here. Would you be interested? And that's when I came on. And then in the winter of 2020, so like during the height of COVID, is when we actually started planning out exactly what the program would look like. In June of 2021, we planted our first garden. And I believe in July of 2021 is where we got our first participant to the program. I think it's great that people are reaching out because they want to engage in some sort of reconciliation.
I was curious why Kiyoki, who did not know of UUism before this project, agreed to be involved. He said it was based on what his community elder, Verna McGregor, said to him after her meeting with representatives from Ottawa First.
They're good people, is what she said. So that solidified for me. It's okay for me to work with this organization.
It's somewhat surprising to me that it went that smoothly, given the history of churches and Indigenous communities.
Me too, to be frank. So I asked Keoki about it.
When you talk about reconciliation and how that goes sometimes between Indigenous people and churches, it can be a complicated history. Was there any sort of reservations by you or your community or anybody about that part of it? Like the church-like, though Unitarian Universalists have a different value set, right?
That's it. It was the value set, I think, that made me different from other organizations.
I asked if Ajashki operated with a covenant, as it is important within many UU cultures. Keoki explained that he doesn't work that way, but instead, him and whatever organization he works with signs a simple three-point agreement. Lynn mentioned that there are differences in the way that Ajashki operates that were hard for some UUs to embrace at the beginning.
So certainly in the way we run things at Ajashki would definitely be considered more an Indigenous way of having an organization, especially when it comes to structure, rather than, of course, First U is more culturally different. And I don't necessarily want to use the word colonial, but something more towards that focus, where everything has a leader to everything and this is the procedures that we follow, rather than at Ajashki. I take lead because, you know, we needed a leader to kind of run the show, but everyone else is the circle of support. We have many circle of support members and they're all just coordinators and we all just help coordinate things. We try to structure Ajashki a little different than First U and all the other smaller organizations under First U.
When we were first getting together to put this project forward, what we had asked for were sort of outside of the ballpark that people were used to providing here. Because it was unusual, it was treated like change often is, and that some people were a little hesitant about it. But what's happened over the past 3 years, as Ajashki has sort of been more in the public eye here locally, and people have come to know what's going on and how the benefits have streamed from it, the relationship with the people who were a little bit hesitant at first has changed. Like, it's just a total change. So we've been very pleased with the evolution. It's difficult to encounter change sometimes, and it just took a little bit of time for people to realize that the change was not going to be a negative change, that there was a lot of positive coming from it.
The impact of the Ajashki project has been very positive.
We've had articles in a local newspaper. Keoki has spoken at a number of in-church and out-of-church events. And that all sort of drew attention to Ajashki that was wider than just the congregation. And they would see those things out in the community. And that drew them to realize that this was something that had positive effects in the community and outside of the Unitarian community.
A lot of people that I've talked to thought with the program, what we're doing here is really great. I don't think I've heard anybody in my community who's had a negative outlook on Ajashki. We've had a few elders come in. My grandmother, who's a very respected elder in my community, came in to do a prayer at the end of the year. We have an end of the year celebration for our summer program, and she thought it was great. We also work with a number of different Indigenous organizations within the Ottawa area. For one, there's Inukatagit, which is an organization that serves Inuit people in Ottawa, which Ottawa has a fairly large Inuit population. We get a lot of our participants from them, 6 or 7 workers from them from the last 2 years. We also worked with New High School, where they would come once a week during our summer program, and their high school kids would work with our youth participants doing what's our everyday activities here. We've worked with a few different Indigenous organizations in Ottawa, and I personally think our relationships and the feedback we've got from them has been great.
What a great example of reconciliation in action through this community-engaged project.
Since our recording, Ottawa First has announced that they have another exciting project underway, and this one has to do with housing. This project will create 220 units of almost entirely affordable housing for Ottawa. And part of this includes 60 units in a building that will be built by Ontario Aboriginal Housing Services on land given to them by the congregation. So another really exciting example of being relevant within the needs of their community, as well as working with the Indigenous community to create projects that have a meaningful impact, not just in what they're creating, but in the ways that they're relating to one another. There was another community-engaged UU initiative that I had the privilege of speaking to. This is Catherine Jane Hazel of the First Unitarian Fellowship of Nanaimo in British Columbia, who spoke at the beginning of our episode explaining what the Nanaimo Unitarian Shelter is and why it was started. She goes into it in more detail here.
It was started to provide housing for homeless people in Nanaimo back in 2008. There was an increase in the number of homeless, and there were some members of our congregation who were very concerned about this. And it was taken to a vote of the congregation to see if we would be willing to provide some sort of shelter for the unhoused. And at that time, it was just during particular extreme weather conditions. They needed more than just a mat on the floor in the church hall. We had been renting out the lower place part of our building to, I never can remember whether it was the Moose or the Elks, but it was one of those animal club groups, and they canceled their lease. And so we moved into that space and started providing shelter. And we were volunteer run for almost 5 years, completely volunteer run, which was quite an undertaking. We've always been the workhorse of the homeless shelter services in Nanaimo. We were the only low barrier shelter. And by that, I mean, if people showed up and they were drunk or stoned, we wouldn't turn them away. Because for us, we felt that's when people are at their most vulnerable. Why would you shut the door to them when they most needed help? And we would take them in, we would take away their alcohol or their drugs and say, you can't use these while you're in the shelter. We will give them back to you when you leave in the morning, but these are the conditions in which you can take shelter here. And I think, we think, and others think that this was actually the best approach, because for some of these people, it was the first time they had been in a detox situation or had any experience of it, because from 7 p.m. at night till 7 a.m. in the morning, they were not using drugs or alcohol. They were getting nutritious food, like a warm meal at dinner time and then breakfast. They were sleeping in clean beds, and there were people there who, if they decided they wanted to move on in their lives, like either by getting into some treatment program or getting housed or whatever, there was some there who would sit down with them and say, okay, what's your plan? What would you like to do?
Apparently, those using the shelter are not limited to folks living with addictions and mental health, as one might imagine.
In actual fact, about a quarter of the people coming to our shelter are seniors who have been renovicted and are either living on the streets or in their cars. We had one man who'd been in a wheelchair living on the streets for almost a year, and he'd been renovicted. There's people who are working. There are people who are on minimum wage and they can't get together the rent. So they stay in our shelter until they can save up enough money to find a place to rent. We've even had international students from Vancouver Island University. They can't find anything that's affordable. We've had people with mental illness, of course. I mean, don't get me started on that. That's a whole nother area. But who can't get treatment? They can't cope with regular housing situation. They need supports that aren't there for them. We have elderly people. For example, Paul came to the shelter one afternoon and there was an elderly woman with her suitcase, and he started asking her about her situation. And she was a woman who's in the beginning stages of dementia, and she'd been taken in by one of these online scams by someone saying, oh, you're the most beautiful woman in the world and I love you, and gradually reeling her in and then asking her to send him money. And she lost all her retirement funds basically and ended up unable to pay her rent. So there she was outside the shelter with no place to go and no fit mental state to find a new place to live. Those are the people who are in shelters now.
This shelter ran for years solely on the volunteer efforts of the fellowship members and financial donations. In 2018, it became a year-round all-weather shelter, which thrust it into a whole other realm that involved negotiating with local and provincial political systems. Their experience with activism was put to good work advocating for the unhoused in their city.
We have gone through major changes. In 2018, we became a year-round weather shelter, which was a big improvement. In the early days when we were extreme weather shelter, the system was just absolutely insane. It was like this poker game we played with the city and the provincial government. We would go and meet with the officials and they would say, okay, we'll fund you if the temperatures are, say, +2 or -2 and sleeting or snowing. And we would come back and say, well, we think it should be +2 and wind and rain. And we'd come to some kind of halfway point. I mean, it was like a poker game and the chips were the unhoused.
It is so moving to see the UU practice of activism coming to life.
Indeed, and it wasn't a peripheral part of their congregational life. It was so central that Catherine estimated that it took up to 60% of their board's time to fundraise and operate the shelter, as well as advocate for other services to support the unhoused in their area.
That is some serious dedication for what, like 16 years? What a profound impact.
Absolutely. In the upcoming episode, we'll learn more about how this group is taking action to ensure that this much needed resource is sustainable into the future. But for now, I will lift them up as an example of a community-based UU ministry that operates as a social service.
I'm very curious to learn about your conversation with the lay chaplains. As you know, I was a lay chaplain many moons ago, which is why I suggested we reach out to them. Lay chaplains are truly a unique flavor of community-based ministry.
And I'm glad you did, because I got to speak with Karen Dunk Green, a lay chaplain from First Unitarian Congregation of Toronto, who explains so eloquently what lay chaplaincy is.
Our lay chaplains team are responsible for offering rites of passage or services to any member of the community who comes looking for that. We advertise outside of the congregation and we welcome anyone who wants to have a service, a ritual performed for them. So the obvious ones are weddings and memorial services. We also do child naming services. We've done other types of blessings. Recently, there have been requests to provide ritual and service in the context of people who are going through the MAID process, even really providing a way for people to co-create these types of services in ways that might not be done in more traditional religious settings. So we're co-creating every single time with people who come and say, I want to mark this moment in my life in an important way that's meaningful to me. How can you help me do that? Our ministers look after those things for our members, but for non-members, we provide that service as a way of extending our reach into the community, as a way of representing Unitarian Universalism across the community, and not making that necessarily part of someone joining the congregation or having a permanent relationship with us. It's essentially an outreach service.
Additionally, for congregations without a minister, lay chaplains can play critical roles in leading ceremonies and providing leadership. The Lay Chaplaincy Initiative began in 1971 through the Canadian Unitarian Council, which included the training of carefully chosen lay members. Karen reflected on the historical context for how that came to be.
Part of the history as well was that there was a real rush of demand when same-sex marriage became legal in Canada, and people knew that Unitarians were open to doing those services, but again, there was a capacity issue. And so there was a real match there between what we were open and willing to provide and what the broader marketplace, if you'll call it that, was looking for, a high volume of activity related to same-sex marriage. We don't see that same volume coming to us anymore because that service is available through many other organizations.
One of the strengths that Unitarian Universalist lay chaplains have is their ability to help people navigate and celebrate diversity.
And that's what she said too. Karen explained how lay chaplains bring this to life.
Quite often we are also contacted by people who are marrying in a multi-faith couple. So there might be one person in the couple is from a Catholic heritage, another person is from a Muslim heritage, whatever the combinations. We see lots of different combined families bringing different cultures together. They're either not allowed, literally, in some cases, to have a service in that mixed way in either of their home cultures. And yet they still want to have a ritual, a ceremony, something that people would recognize as a service. And so they come to us having heard that we're willing to create something with them that will combine elements of their cultures that make sense to them and that are meaningful to their families. And we really create something unique every single time that is suitable for them. So that happens a lot in the marriage side of things.
Besides ethnic diversity, UU lay chaplains are equipped to co-create ceremonies that celebrate other types of diversities, such as relationship structure.
If we're talking about diversity and actually having people recognize that diverse types of relationships are welcome within our community, that is a particular story that's true around lay chaplaincy. I mean, I talked about people of mixed races and mixed cultures. I didn't talk about poly groups, poly families, but definitely that's been a demand and it's been a reason why people have come to. As people have approached me who are in poly relationships and they are getting married and they want someone to marry them who understands the nature of their relationship, what I find interesting is in any of the cases where I've been approached that way, in the end, the ceremony has not been different than anyone else's ceremony. There haven't been different words declaring the polyamorous situation. There haven't been extra other partners participating alongside the married couple. All they've really wanted is to be able to say, this is our relationship. And I think to be able to say, this is our relationship, and be married by someone who knows that helps people to feel that they've legitimately been married in their relationship. They want to be able to be who they are and to be open about it with the person who is blessing their marriage. So, I mean, as you know, we're not allowed to do ceremonies that involve polyamorous couples specifically or polyamorous family structures specifically. We can't bring more than two people into a ceremony of union, but we can talk to those people and understand and accept and celebrate that they are coming to be married in that larger context of who they are. So I have found it fascinating that no one has asked me to do a ceremony that actually looks any different to anyone else. What they want is for me to know that this is who they are.
I found it fascinating to hear about how UU chaplains have been navigating the balance between being radically inclusive as UUs and complying with governmental law.
And historically, when it came to recognizing same-sex unions, lay chaplains and UU ministers were performing non-legal queer unions decades before it became legalized in Canada. It was not only about honoring diversity, but was activism as well, which speaks to my heart.
Right, and a modern times equivalent is in recognizing unions between people who are polyamorous. As Karen said, lay chaplains and ministers have to be very careful not to appear to be joining more than two people at a time, even if no one is becoming legally married under Canadian law. When I inquired about why there doesn't appear to be as much of an activist stance from members of the UU Task Force on Polyamory, I heard concerns about the potential of Unitarian Universalists coming under scrutiny from government and losing the ability to marry people.
It goes to show how things have progressed over time. All this is new to me. And it's interesting because if it was like a welcome to the family ceremony where someone is being adopted or welcomed into family intentionally, more than two people could take part. But if it appears to be too similar to a legal marriage, then like alarm bells will sound.
Right. And I appreciate the thoughtful consideration that's going into how to navigate this muddy territory. The Canadian Unitarian Council striking a task force to examine the issues demonstrates how seriously this form of inclusion is being taken, as well as the desire to take action in a productive way. Some would say there's an opportunity to introduce activism in action here by hosting a spiritual union ceremony for more than two, as opposed to the legal marriage ceremony. Lay chaplains could help society move towards greater recognition of a range of relationships and family structures.
True. And I appreciate that this action, if it were to be taken sometime in the future, would be done with full awareness of the potential consequences. For those listeners interested in learning more, the Polyamory Task Force released a report that we will link in the show notes.
As we wind down this episode, it's worth noting the way in which lay chaplains are engaging as they make their services available to the broader community, and in doing so, share UU values in action. Each of the lay chaplains undergo specific training by the Canadian Unitarian Council, and in that training, they are introduced to the types of ceremonies they may be called upon to design. It's significant here to use the word design instead of perform or facilitate or execute, and that these ceremonies are not cookie cutter. They are designed with the people involved and have specific meaning to them. Here's Karen to explain more.
You're meeting with family members who have said, we want to do something, we need some support, but they always come with an idea of what it is that they're trying to achieve. And we're always in a long dialogue in some cases about which words are the right words, which rituals are the right rituals, what's the right order of events here, what are the right elements that are going to be meaningful to your family as opposed to anything that I might have done in the last ceremony or the last ceremony. I've talked a lot about weddings, but for me, the memorial services are in some ways more meaningful and more interesting because there's even more of a sense that there's this sort of blank slate. It's all a co-creation. It's all about bringing together all the elements that are going to be meaningful. And we're a guide and we provide some structure. And I find that most of the time also what we provide is just an assurance that what they feel they want to do is okay, that what they feel they want to have happen in the ceremony is allowed, because there's still this sense that, well, there's a way you're supposed to do things. And we talk with people right up front that what you're supposed to do is just what is meaningful to you. It doesn't have to look the way someone else's ceremony looked. So it's very much a representation of this idea that everyone can be involved and that we do this so that it matters and is meaningful each and every time. The lay chaplain practice really does capture this idea of co-creation very well.
Once again, we hear the word co-creating being brought up where the ceremony is highly personalized to those involved and is about the experience as opposed to the performance.
And it's very similar to what we heard is happening in the other expressions we interviewed, who are all aiming to be more intergenerational or creative in their times of worship and community.
Co-creating is emerging as an approach that is very common within UUism as a whole. And so it's exciting and validating that the lay chaplains are sharing UU values with the broader community in this way.
That UUs are known as co-creators of beautiful, inclusive ceremonies is such a powerful and telling way to welcome people into our faith, whether it's for a long or a short time. And we know that their outreach works. I was married by a UU lay chaplain who co-created a custom mixed culture ceremony with me and my then partner, which is how I learned about UUism.
Wow, very cool. I didn't know that. And I agree. In the upcoming episodes, we'll carry on the conversation with Karen regarding lay chaplaincy. She and I explore ways to amplify the good work this group is already doing and build the collective capacity to outreach deeper into the community. We even began imagining how to incorporate social enterprise aspects to sustain their work and enhance their impact. It's a very interesting conversation that I look forward to sharing.
Sounds very rich. I must say, there are some impactful community-based initiatives happening, and I'm sure that there are more that we haven't even heard of yet. These initiatives are bringing UU values to life in the world that really benefit the communities they're a part of.
Yes, and there's a lot of great energy and vibrancy happening. In the next two episodes, we'll delve more deeply into these initiatives, which will include episode 7 called Money and episode 8 called Potential.
I look forward to it.